unpacking going?
It's going. I have to say I'm pretty happy with how it is. We still have a few boxes, but I don't think that is too bad. We've been in 10 days. So, yeah, we've got a few boxes still lurking in the living room. We just need to find where best to put them. And then, we're sorted. We had to do a lot of cleaning and bits and pieces. So we had a few other priorities.
Actually, I should have known that you'd be organised. I don't even know why I asked the question thinking you'd say that you were still submerged in boxes. Because knowing you as I do, you get in, there's a task. It's a bit like getting our podcast up and running. We had a chat. We thought maybe we should do this. Next minute, you're like, right, let's go. So I should have known that you would be unpacked. We've been in our current house, I want to say 5 years. And there's still a room full of boxes. It was due to be an office. It's still due to be an office. But there's still stuff I think I haven't unpacked. And I can blame everything. I can blame children and work and life. But I think it's just me a little bit. Do you know what I mean? So I should have known that you've pretty much nailed it. And the boxes. You know what? If I ever move house, can I hire you to come and just do it? You do that?
I don't know if that's necessarily a skill of mine, but I know what you mean. I think it's fine to blame stuff, to be honest. I think Ben said to me today, you know, when are these boxes going to go? And I was like, well, I'm in the middle of doing Madrid at the moment, which is taking priority. So I'm off a bit next week. So next week sound good?
Whereas my other half is like, are there still boxes? I'm like, yes, and they are yours. Very different dynamics here. Madrid, you mentioned Madrid. The weird thing about Madrid is you have this women's tournament, which as we speak, what day are we? Because it's bank holiday in the UK, so it always gets me. Is it Thursday today? It's Thursday today.
It is, so yes, it is.
We've got a women's tournament that's at the semi-final stage. And we've got a men's tournament that's at the third round stage. So it's quite hard when I'm not working on Madrid, but I'm following it. It's kind of like, okay, so they're at the semi-finals. Wow, they're just getting started. So it's a little bit, so we're nearly there. And I don't know, I know you're working on the men's tournament, but the women's, Teichmann and Pegula and then Alexandrova against Jabeur. I mean, probably not the four we would have put in for the final four at the start of the tournament.
No, it's been extraordinary. I mean, the seeds tumbled out very, very quickly. We were missing a few of the top players anyway. Swiatek wasn't playing. Yeah. Krejcikova is still out injured. What an amazing opportunity for one of those four. And for Ons, it's felt like a little bit of a long time coming, hasn't it? The last 12 months, she's been threatening so much and played some fantastic tennis. But, you know, the pressure is on for her when you look at those four, really, isn't it? And it's still tough with the ones that are remaining. So it's been really good fun to watch, I think, the women's, because we have had those newer names getting on the big stadiums and playing those big matches, which, well, I say newer, not necessarily newer, but newer to this stage of a tournament.
And including players we haven't seen for a while, like Bianca Andreescu. I have such a soft spot for Andreescu, and I'm just so happy to see her and playing some of the tennis that she's been playing. It's just, if she can stay fit and healthy, it's going to be so good to have her back on tour.
Why do you think you have a soft spot for her? What do you think it is about her?
I like her. I like her attitude. It's weird. It's a little bit, and I know you'll disagree with me. I have a bit of a soft spot for Sofia Kenin, and everyone's like, "What?" She kind of stamps around. She kind of looks like she's sulking a lot of the time. I like Andreescu's. I like the attitude. There's something about when she plays on the court, and I remember interviewing her at Eastbourne, and of all the players I was interviewing, the WTA players, she was the one for me that had the presence. Do you know that? I don't know how you even describe a presence, but do you know what I mean? Like, when I went to interview her, she felt like she had a presence, and she was so smiley and so nice and so friendly. But I think she's got some attitudes. She got fantastic game. I like her story. I like the way she talks. I don't know. I just, there's a little bit of everything that I like Andreescu, and I like her being part of the tour.
Yeah, I couldn't be in more agreement. On both counts, we know that that Tennis is a big Kenin fan. The pod, both of us, we've done quite a lot of chat about Kenin. But also Andreescu. Oh, good news on Kennen is that she seems to be recovering from her injury. We've seen some training updates and that sort of thing. So that's all looking positive. Good. But positive. So fingers crossed we see her back. But for Andreescu, I'm just desperate to see peak Andreescu against peak Osaka on a hard court. It's never happened. They didn't overlap with their peaks, and it would just be extraordinary. I mean, unbelievable, because for me, you know, no one has played that level of tennis on a hard court since Serena was at her peak, but that was some years ago. So in the last sort of 5 years, hard court tennis for me, it has been those two. Who knows what Ash would have gone on to do after winning the Australian Open. She might have been able to challenge it again with a slightly different game style. But the Osaka-Andreescu thing, it's quite a similar game style. It's that big baseline hitting from the back of the court, and you've got the drop shots from Andreescu that Osaka's not going to like. Anyway, I still would love for that to be a rivalry. I'm desperate for Andreescu to get back to her peak.
Yeah, absolutely. I just love watching. I love watching her play. I love the attitude that she has. So fingers crossed she stays healthy. When I'm talking about healthy, now this is a question for you because it might be a very simple answer, but Emma Raducanu did some really good things in Madrid, but then talk of another injury for Emma Raducanu. Now she's had a few since, and we know this is her first full season on tour. Is this? And you might not know the answer to this, or it might be a simple answer. Is it? No, and I can't even use her age because you've got Świątek, who's not much older at 20. So there are young players who are not getting a lot of injuries. But with Raducanu, because, you know, whether it's blisters or back, etc., could it be just the pressure of not going from nothing to everything? I mean that in the sense of tour playing, in the sense of coming through the US Open, and now she's on the tour full time. Do you think that could be a reason for some of these injuries? Is it just her body maturing? Is it just some people are more injury prone than others?
I think she just hasn't done it enough, really. That's not her fault. It's just how it's worked out. You know, when you go through the challenges and you work your way up, part of it is your body adapting to each stage. And you know, when you first achieve something, you're going to be feeling very stiff, very sore, playing at a certain level, and then your body gets used to it, and then that stops happening. There is that part of it, which I think is the main part, really. It's just the body getting used to things. And then the other part is that she has always been slightly injury prone. Nothing super serious, nothing mega. There are injury prone players where it goes really bad, and it's nothing like that. So it's no reason to panic. But really, for years, she's been playing with niggles or tape and all those sorts of things going on. So it's just something that I think she's used to managing. And definitely, I mean, this is a, you know, stratospheric leap up in level that she is working with. So the body's just taking a bit of a hit. So some people would say she's getting injury after injury after injury, and they're always different as well, right? It's not the same thing. It's always something different. It was blisters on the hand, and then it was blisters on the feet or whatever it is. But she is also not getting seriously injured. So she is managing it to an extent. So there's a good amount of success, but it's obviously not ideal. Her and her team would love to get to the point where she wasn't constantly having to manage this, because it's draining. It's just very annoying and distracting when you're playing a match. If you've got something that hurts, whether it's a blister, a cut, or a pulled muscle, or whatever it might be, it's just annoying. And you just want to get on and play, really. But she played very, very well in Madrid. There are some significant improvements, I think, in her game. Could be in the nick of time for the grass, which would be very, very helpful, of course, with so much focus on her. But yeah, I think no reason for real concern.
God, the amount of talking we are going to be doing about Emma Raducanu when the grass kicks in is going to be insane. As much as we're going to try and temper it and not go over the top with it. Even on this podcast, there's going to be so much focus. There is going to be so much talk. So to actually be Raducanu herself and what's about to happen, even though what's already happened, you just feel it's going to be another level again. You think, well, how could it be another level again? She's won the US Open from nowhere, and she's been to the Met Ball or the Met Gala, the one, not the one we've just had, the one before. But Gross, I mean, you've talked in the past about the pressure of yourself coming into Wimbledon, suddenly the people wanting to do interviews and press conferences. You just feel that Raducanu, she's going to have to be so mentally, I know we're talking about being physically strong. She's going to have to be so mentally strong coming into this grass court season.
Yeah, I suppose the good thing is that the demand for her time and attention is there everywhere she goes. So, yeah, it's going to be ramped up big time at the grass, but it's not like it's just going to happen out of nowhere. She's very used to having 1,001 requests every tournament that she goes to. So, so I don't think it will throw her off too much. It will just... I think just be a combination, as I say, the expectations, the extra eyeballs on her, especially in the UK. So that will be, it'll be interesting to see how she deals with it. I think she's going to do pretty well with it.
Talking about expectations, someone who seems to be navigating it very well is Coco Gauff. And I don't know if you saw a lovely piece done by a colleague and good friend, Reem Abalel. I think it was for Eurosport for Reem, it's fabulous because she's been remote like so many of us for so long. And now she's back on the road and she's in Madrid so she can speak to coaches and families and players. And so nice for these guys to be back out there and face to face with the players and the support staff. But she did, I don't know if you read it, it's a lovely piece with Coco Gauff and the dad, Corey, who's also the coach, just about managing expectations and having been around for so long already, and she's still so young. And some other players on tour, she said, sort of regularly forget how young she still is, and wanting to be the best and having to sort of get the right team around her and realise that there's more to life than tennis, which, when you think about it, for someone still so young, it's a very grown-up attitude to have, but she just seems to have good people around her and she's starting to manage expectations.
Yeah, it's felt like it's steadied out a bit. So I think they've made some different decisions, some changes. It's a hard one to call because you can't blame them for getting caught up in the Call Me Coco wave that we had.
Yeah.
Much like with Emma and her endorsement deals. Of course, this is the point. You've dedicated your life to this. You are one of the best in the world. And any endorsement deals that come your way, yes, please. I mean, I defy anybody to say, oh, no, that's too much money. No, thank you. And, you know, I mean, Coco was signing a $1 million deal at 15. So it was absolutely extraordinary. So, but I think that it was then what all came with that. I think that's also something that we're going to see Emma work out as well. Because, the biggest thing for me was the Coco entourage. It was
enormous.
It was unbelievable. I don't think I've ever seen an entourage like that for anyone.
So
I can't
big.
Think of anyone. I mean, because she would have her player box rammed full and then would have at least another two rows behind rammed full. I don't know how she was getting her hands on these sorts of tickets, because it's hard for players to get that amount of tickets and get those amount of people in the building. And so it was huge. And none of those people were of kids her own age or friends or anyone like that. And I'm not saying that is an easy thing to do. It's just an observation. So that, you know, they're all adults and whatever. So that's all gone away now, which I think is right. Take the endorsement deals, but then get rid of the entourage, the hanger-oners and that sort of thing. And it's about that fine balance. Of course, you want to maximise you, your business, everything financially. Look, Serena's set to become the first billionaire. Is it billionaire female athlete? I don't know what she's...
Yeah, incredible.
She's going to be a billionaire. She's going to be a billionaire. I mean, who cares, right? Look, of course, you know, the players want to do that. And it's something that we love about tennis, that the level of opportunity is bigger than in any other female sport. And but it's hard when that's happening as a teenager. It's difficult to get it all right, and they're going to make some mistakes. But it is really nice, and I did really enjoy Reem's article, and to hear what we're hearing is sort of mirroring what we're seeing. I think we're seeing Coco playing very calmly, self-assured on the court. I think she looks really, really great. That little frantic edge has gone, which is good. Still some question marks, technique on the serve, second serve, double faults, you know, where we're at with that. But it's going to be constant improvement, I'm sure. And then also with the less people around, and it just seems to be a bit more of a professional operation going on. So the article just seemed to really say that they're in a good place. They've had to deal with an awful lot and, everyone's looking forward. And I think that's what we're seeing from her. So I really buy into it.
Yeah, really nice to hear from her dad as well, telling her, and he wasn't suggesting she's not putting the work in, but sort of saying to her, if you want to be the best of the very, very, very best, you're going to have to work like them, and you're going to have to put in that effort, and you're going to have to do everything. And we talked about this numerous times before. Medvedev made that leap by realizing that he had to go the extra mile. Whatever that extra mile is for that person, whether it's cutting out something, doing more of something, figuring out yourself, listening to someone that maybe you hadn't listened to in the past, whatever it is, you have to have that moment when you think, okay, that's the extra thing I have to do to get where I need to be. And look, a lot of the younger players have family on tour. He's also her main coach. They have other people working with her, but it just, and the mother isn't always there because obviously it's not just Coco in the family, but you're right. It seems like a lovely family. And yes, the entourage, which I remember, was that US Open? I remember just counting the rows and thinking that is the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. they went on for miles. But you're right, it seems like the deals are done, things have settled, and she's figuring herself out. It's what any teenage girl or boy does at that age. They've got to figure themselves out anyway. And like Raducanu, they're kind of doing it in the media glare. Which, I don't know, does this... All right, there's two ways we could go now. Now, this could lead us on to retirement. We could go from the extremes of starting out to retirement. Or there was something and someone that you wanted to talk about last week for this week.
Let's talk about... We can talk about the retirements first.
Yeah.
I think that would be a good way to go. Although, actually, why don't we go to the opposite end of retirements? Agnieszka Radwanska, what's going on there? I hear she is... making a comeback. Now, I don't know if this is 100% confirmed. I saw quotes from her, and I'm not 100% convinced what's going on. But apparently she's coming back. And
she's had a baby, hasn't she?
Yes, she did, yeah.
Yeah. So do you think... I was thinking, I didn't see anything about the comeback, but I've seen her with her sort of... I think she's about one or something, isn't she now? Do you think it's that kind of... I remember you telling me, I know this was different, you were younger, and then there's been a few years, but part of the reason was, you know, you look ahead, you want to have the family, you want to settle down. Do you think maybe in some of these cases, and we've seen this with some sort of mums coming back, that, you know, one of the motivations maybe to stop is to settle and have a family. And once that's kind of underway, you start thinking, well, hang on a second, I'm still, in their cases, in pretty good nick. I could maybe balance this. There's more, it's more accommodating now, isn't it, for mums in terms of childcare and creches on tour, that maybe, and add into that, I probably kind of miss what I did for so long.
Well, yeah, I think it's also seeing that it's possible. You know, we're seeing Azarenka on tour and Tatiana Maria now with her couple of kids. And it, as you say, it is much more set up for it. It's just much more normal. And you can see what Serena's been able to achieve after having a baby. Azarenka, you know, it's there, right? It's an option. That I don't think can be ignored. So I think we'll see more and more players sort of doing something similar. I mean, of course, Kim Clijsters what she was doing there. But I think people sort of put that down to being a bit phenomenal, I would think, at the time. It was just so ridiculous what she was doing. But now it's sort of like, oh, okay, yeah, somebody's coming back from having a baby like that. Just, yeah, sure, great, good for them. It's just about whether you can make that life work on tour. I mean, Joanna Konta said that, you know, she hasn't had a baby yet, but she was saying that, you know, I don't imagine that is the way that I would go. But you never know. As I say, it's an option now. It didn't really feel like an option before. So, I don't know. It's exciting anyway.
Yeah, no, I've actually spoken to a player who said they'd love to sort of experience motherhood and then resume their career. You know, just because, again, it's possible. And these things, one person I don't think we'll see back is Caroline Wozniacki. I know she's dealing with other things physically as well, but I don't know about you. I don't see her, unless you know different. I don't see her making a return to tennis.
No, I agree. But I don't know, if she did, great. It'd be cool.
Yeah, no, great. Yeah, she was, I saw a picture of her at the Met Gala ball. Which one do I call it? Don't know, maybe both. But I saw a picture of her. I don't see her coming back. But Taylor Townsend, didn't she recently win one of the lower level tournaments? She's a mum.
100K.
Yeah, and then she said, I love it. She said, right, back to the day job, which is great because that's an interesting way of viewing it, because pre-baby, tennis was the day job.
Yeah.
But she's kind of saying, you know, my day job's my little one, but and she's been doing stuff for Tennis Channel. So I think you're right. The big thing in there is it's possible. And a few years ago, it wasn't. And I speak to players. These are male players who are long retired. I spoke to one and he said that he didn't want to have children while he was playing because he said tennis was too much, he had to be too selfish. You know, and that's coming from the guy's point of view. But he said, I didn't want, you know, the distractions and I had to really focus on myself. So he didn't start a family till he was retired. And you could say it could be slightly easier for the man to start a family and maybe just then the family or the wife won't travel so much. But he actually said, I didn't want those distractions. And again, when he was playing, you didn't have everything in place to make it possible again. So, I think you're right. I think we're going to see more players do that, whether it's men starting a family earlier or women having one and coming back. But someone who started a family, isn't coming back, has confirmed he's not coming back, is Kevin Anderson.
Yes, it is the farewell of Big Kev, which is a nice opportunity to really reflect on what he has achieved. I mean, what a maximizer in terms of getting the absolute most out of him. 2 Grand Slam finals, am I correct?
Yep.
2
yep. Grand US Slam Open, finals. Wimbledon.
And Wimbledon. And yeah, it's always a nice opportunity to relive the best moments, isn't it, of a career. But yeah, it's been difficult for him recently. The body's just sort of said, "Look, I think we're done here, Kev." And he's just someone. I mean, you just could not have asked for more in, say, like a player to work with as a coach. You know, so much energy on the court the whole time. He was more than just a big serve and big forehand, as you know, some of the tall guys can be. An amazing career, an amazing achievement. I mean he's had some fantastic matches from Kevin, and I mean the attitude, that's the thing that stands out the most, isn't it? I mean that relentless positivity. Sometimes did border on a little bit ridiculous, like second point of the match and there's this massive come on, like just shouting at himself, come on, and he's like, okay,
but do you remember when do you remember when he went through that concerted change to do that? Because everyone's like, he's such a nice guy. And I was like, oh, he's so nice. It's something we level at Marin Cilic. Oh, he's so nice. He's too nice. And then Kevin Anderson made this change to do these come-ons and these fist pumping after, as you say, first, second, every point. And at first, it just was so not him. We were like, what's he doing? But, you know, that change in him... You know, he got to the final of the US Open in 2017. There was Wimbledon in 2018. But you're right, it didn't fit. It felt, especially at first, it felt quite forced, didn't it? That he was constantly kind of trying to gee himself up.
Yeah, it was a little bit jarring at first, but it worked. And, you know, you do have to sort of dig deep into areas of your personality that aren't necessarily natural. You know, I mean, just... Some people are naturally that competitive and sort of lunatics with it. And other people, they need to, each stage they hit, they need to find a bit more, you know, to be able to bring what they need to the court. So you've got to work with what you've got, haven't you? But just brilliant. I mean, no one has a bad word to say about Kevin. He's just been awesome. I hope he stays involved in the sport. You know, also as a South African player, you know, because we don't have an abundance of South African players, it's been so important for him to be right at the top of the sport, I think, for that nation and everything that he's done. I couldn't rave about him anymore. Wouldn't you just love to just have a nice chat with him? He just seems like the nicest guy.
He's such a nice guy. And his wife, Kelsey, as well. And she made the decision. I think she had a job as an accountant. She was a stunningly good golfer to travel with him full time. And she was writing about it, wasn't she? She was writing about life on tour and about the finances. And it was so interesting. She was talking about how much money they would spend in flights in a year. And that at one stage, you know, Kevin and his coach, they'd share a room. And it was only when she started traveling, they had to get the extra room. And that's the extra money. And it was just such an interesting insight that she broke down the finances and how much it actually cost if you were traveling and everything that goes with it. And she was always happy. I remember she'd be always happy to talk and to give you her time. And it was just, yeah, she gave you, I know, isn't it Taylor Fritz's girlfriend was kind of blogging or following the tour with Taylor Fritz and kind of doing posts and pieces about tennis and how it's so cool and it's so fun and giving an insight. And I think what Kelsey did was kind of opened up how expensive it is. Yes, for the guys at the very top, Novak Djokovic probably hasn't got a clue what he spends on flights. Actually, it's probably his own plane. I mean, I don't know. But, you know, for those lower down, and you know about this, you know, the costs and having to travel. So, yeah, they were lovely. They were, but, you know, and we mentioned his finals, but it was that Wimbledon semi-final 2018, John Isner, over, what, it was 6.5 hours, and it finished him off. I remember him saying afterwards that the night before the final, he was calling his physio at like 2 a.m. screaming in pain, and that Kelsey was having to get the physio to go into his room to look at him because he was in so much pain. You know, it killed any chance he would have had in that final because, and that's the rules started to change, and now we know those matches will not go on and on and on and on. But I remember at the time, poor old Isner in long matches, but there was Isner against Anderson, but he was broken, wasn't he? He'd reached the Wimbledon final, and you knew as he walked out that he was physically completely broken.
Well, you have to be. It's just ridiculous. Like, I mean, how you can come back and play the day after that and the most important match of your career. So, yeah, that was probably the most memorable moment, wasn't it? I think in his career. So, yeah, I'm. The thing is, like people say, oh, you know, it's sad news. I mean, it's not sad news because I'm happy for him. I'm sure he's going to go on to some great things and live a really great and happy life. But it's a shame for us that we don't get to see him play anymore because he was always fun.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Madrid, what have you made of what you've seen? And as we speak, Andy Murray should have been playing Novak Djokovic, but the statement came through that Andy Murray had pulled out due to illness. What have you made of what has gone on in Madrid to this point?
Yeah, such a shame, that big blow for Andy. He'd played so well to give himself the chance of a crack of Djokovic, and you know he would have just been chomping at the bit for that. So he must be very unwell to not be able to take to the court. So he was great. Really, he's played very, very well. Things are looking good for the grass court season, that's for sure. And what else has been going on in Madrid? You know, it's just this thing with tennis tournaments. It all does start to blur.
They blend, don't they? Yeah. Well, we've got Nadal and Djokovic, first draw together since Roland Garros 2021.
Yes,
so they're in the top.
Nadal's played one match and has looked very, very strong.
Yeah. Excellent.
I think he did a really good job. Djokovic also very, very, like, everybody's playing really well. It's a very exciting draw. The men's draw has panned out quite differently to the women's in that it's felt really stacked with experience, and you've had quite a few sort of later breakthroughs. We had an epic match yesterday between Hurkacz when he took out Davidovich Fokina in the final set breaker. And Davidovich Fokina obviously had the home crowd, and it was an amazing atmosphere, sort of sounded like Davis Cup. We had Pablo Carreño Busta as a Spaniard once again for the third time this year, having match points and losing. He had two match points on his own serve, and he lost to Botic van der Sandschulp. And I was commentating on that match, and that was tough. It was tough to watch that, especially knowing that last year in Madrid, he was 6-3-4 love up, I believe, before losing his match. So a bit of some mental demons going on for PCB.
And especially with your soft spot for PCB. We must not forget you have a soft spot for PCB. We haven't heard about your soft spot because you sort of wandered off to Riley Opelka for a little bit. But we've got
Opelka
to remember that...
No, I'm all in on Alejandro at the moment.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, it means I have to mention Andrei Rublev, obviously.
Yes.
Currently, I know this can be very out of date, but we always need to give a mention to Rublev. He's set in a breakup on Dan Evans, because that was the match, wasn't it, that was moved to kick things off in replace of the Djokovic. Yeah.
Belgrade champion Rublev.
Yeah, of course. He's doing well, isn't he? Hopefully he'll believe in himself fully, but he looks like he's got a good lead over Dan Evans. We've also got Alcaraz in this top half of this draw, and I think Hurkacz, you mentioned, top half of the draw, and Norrie is in there too. So, and then it feels like, so the bottom half, you've got what? A Zverev in there, you've got a Tsitsipas in there, you know, it's full. I mean, this Madrid draw is heaving.
It really is. It is absolutely heaving. It's hard to pick a winner. Of course, all eyes on Nadal and Djokovic to see what level they can bring. But, you know, Tsitsipas has been playing very, very well as well. And Alcaraz, interestingly, in an interview that he did this week, he doesn't like being called Carlos. Did you hear this one?
No. What does he want to be called?
He said, I don't like Carlos. I think it's Carlitos that he prefers, the Spanish version. Or, get this, Charlie.
I mean, I suppose, is Carlos the Spanish for Charles?
Well, I guess so. I didn't know that. Oh, yeah, because the
must be
Moya. Carlos Moya was. Charlie. Remember a couple of references to Charlie Moya. So yeah, so Carlos saying, I can't introduce him as Charlie Alcaraz. Anyway, it was just quite funny, just the way that it was said. It was Carlitos or Charlie.
Yeah, even if you say, even if you say Carlitos, it sounds like you're being over friendly. Do you know what I mean? That sounds like.
Yes,
a
it
nickname.
Does. Yeah, exactly.
So they're either going to say, oh, well, right, look at her using the little nicknames here. And then suddenly calling, I mean, he has to, I mean, I guess it gets to a point if, I guess, look, there's Sasha and Alexander, I was about to say Dr, but that's the female version, you know, it's, or Alex Zverev. I guess there's, whereas Bublik doesn't want to be called Sasha, he wants to be, you know, so, I mean, I guess if he comes out and says, look, I want to be called Charlie, but he doesn't look like a Charlie. You see what I mean? Alcaraz.
Maybe it'll catch on. Who knows? Maybe he'll change his name. I don't know. We'll see. But yes, of course, Alcaraz looking awesome, playing well, fresh off a victory in Barcelona. So maybe he's just going to win every match he ever plays in Spain. That could possibly happen. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Did we pick a winner for Madrid? Or winners for Madrid? Did we do that?
No, we didn't do that.
I thought, so, I mean, I obviously thought Ongjabeur would get to the semi-finals.
Oh, really? I was all in on Alexandrova.
Were you? Okay, I think we can still pick a winner in the men's. I think we're not into it enough. So, okay, now, I think it's even harder now, looking how things are shaking. Who's going to win Madrid?
Nadal.
Is he?
Yeah, look, he played Kecmanovic in his opening match, and Kecmanovic is one of the players of the season so far. Now, I know he's not Nadal levels in terms of, you know, just winning everything, but Kecmanovic has been playing at such a high level. And it was really interesting, actually, that we heard, because Nalbandian is coaching Kecmanovic, and I love this. I really want to get stuck into this at some point as well, because Nalbandian started working with Kecmanovic at the beginning of 2021. Yeah. The whole of 2021 was not good for Kecmanovic. Like, he really, really struggled. But they clearly saw something long term. I mean, that is a big coach to get as a player in terms of seeing the potential. Yeah. And obviously for Kecmanovic to stick with him, even though results just weren't coming. And then, you know, it's all coming together now, and he is awesome. But Nalbandian was obviously with Kecmanovic in this match and has experience against Nadal, I think. But I think he was heard backstage by one of our cameras. There was a rain delay when they were off, and it was just, okay, with his forehand how it is today, we're not going to go to the forehand. Yeah, because, you know, there's always that. The thing is there's always that slight question mark. He hasn't played for a while. He's had a rib injury. What's Nadal going to be like? And then you go, oh, it's Nadal. And the question mark's always over that forehand, because there was that one period of time the weight of the forehand vanished.
Yes, it did.
And it came back, and it's been back ever since. But there was that one period of time years ago, and that's what his opponents cling on to. They go, well, maybe the forehand won't be there. And then within the first point, they go, okay. Now what do we do?
I want to think that was around 2016, but I'm notoriously bad with dates, so that might not
yeah,
be
let's
the
go
case.
With that. Sounds good to me.
Sounds all right. I think it's going to be a Nadal Zverev final, and
yeah.
Zverev likes his conditions. We know he does. Won it before. He can come into form from no form with Zverev.
Yes.
Zverev
didn't look brilliant in his opening match against Cilic. He did very, very well. He beat him in three, a bit of a slow start. But it was one of those where he lost the first set. And I mean, Cilic played really, really well. But he lost the first set and he just sort of looked like he knew he was going to win. He just knew, you know, after that first set, he got broken a couple of times and he was just thinking, well, you know, I just got to tidy this up and that up and that's fine and then I'll win the match. And that is sort of what happened, really. You know, so he was right to feel like that. But the first time he won Madrid, he didn't get broken at all in the whole tournament.
No.
And he got broken twice in the first set against Cilic.
Oh, well, I'm making that as the final. And then, yeah, I'll probably edge it to Well, look, I put Nadal to win Roland Garros, so I've got to give him... And look, it was great to see Team back. I know he was beaten by Andy Murray, who's had some nice words for him at the net. But, you know, Team is back and he's playing, and that's great. Now, something we didn't have time for last week. I think we were just catching up on everything because I'd been away. You wanted to talk about an interview that Pam Shriver recently gave.
Yeah, so it was a really courageous thing for her to do. She did an interview. It was with the Daily Telegraph in the UK and with the Tennis Podcast. So you can either listen to it or read through it if you'd like. Just detailing the relationship that she had with her coach when she was a teenager. And they had a romantic relationship starting when she was 17 and he was 50. And just quite... It was an extraordinary piece to read, but it was something that is, I don't want to say common, it's not common, but it's something that happens in the world of tennis with coaches and players. And you've got teenage girls, essentially, we talked about it earlier, Emma, Coco, all these young women, and they are essentially operating as professionals in the world, and
yeah.
And you have really difficult dynamics between coaches and players, and that is what I find really fascinating, is that the coach is in a position of authority, so it feels like, and I think this is what Pam was saying, it feels like a breach of trust and responsibility that the person in the position of authority would allow that to happen. It was all consensual. You know, it was all, you know, all of that's fine. But, you know, again, it's the dynamic of the situation that makes it very interesting. And so I'm just interested to see what you sort of thought about it or think about that as a thing, because you have. So for players, what's really challenging, I think, for the female players is you're looking for a coach to come and start. Take you and your team in a direction, and you want them to sort of take charge. But you have this situation where the coach is trying to take charge, but they're not in charge because you could fire them over breakfast. So, yeah. And you can, and players do. It happens all the time where the coach has absolutely no idea, and one day it's done, and that's it. So it's a very insecure job to have, and it's a very stressful place to be in. And we see lots of players who do incredibly well and then get rid of coaches, and the coaches are left sort of baffled. You know, that's sort of, then you have long-term coaches that work with players from such a young age, that happens across both the men's and the women's tour. So it's a very strange environment, and it does leave I think it open for sort of exploitation, I think, of young players, and for coaches to put themselves in a position and be unprofessional. It was really a fascinating read that Pam was able to explain her story with all of the nuance, with all of the detail. You know, it's not black and white one way or another. She said she still has mixed feelings towards her former coach. And yeah, it must be a very hard thing to digest, and even harder to try and explain to people.
And I think especially you have some insight in the sense that you've been a young tennis player and you've had these working relationships and you've seen other that have been in situations working with all male groups, etc. I think coming from myself on the outside, at the age of 12, 13, I wasn't on a tennis court or any kind of athletic pitch or place or sports hall being put through my paces and having someone working very closely with some, do you know what I mean, who's a lot older than me, sort of trying to guide me and trying to get to some place. I was probably just running around like a lunatic at that age, or playing with dolls, or probably knowing me watching football or sport, or do you know what I mean? So it's very hard to, when you see what she says, because Pam Shriver said that the pair's relationship started when she was 17 and her coach was 50, and that just sounds horrific when you see, you know, how could he take advantage of someone at that age? And as you said, it was all very consensual, but you know, she is a young girl who is leaning on someone who is guiding her. They are spending, as I say, I you know, a lot of time together. The families have trust and faith in this person who is guiding this person, and you can see, and I've spoken to a couple of coaches before who have said that they haven't had inappropriate relationships, but they could see how feelings can start. Do you know what I mean? Because you're with, and this was a male coach, and he was coaching, she was probably late teenager as she was then, but you spend a lot of time together. You are with this person all the time. It's almost like you're in a bubble. Do you know what I mean? It's not reality. You're traveling with this person, talking to this person. You might be confiding in this person because that's the only person around there, or the only person that will understand what you're going through. Again, I'm coming from completely the outside of this. I can see how those relationships would start to form when you're in this bubble of maybe two or a few more, and this person is sort of guiding you, and you're relying on this person to achieve a dream, to achieve a goal. And Pam Shriver said she believes that abusive coaching relationships are alarmingly common in sport as a whole. So it's a quote from the interview. So we're not talking tennis, we're talking lots of other sports. I think for me, though, the thing, she was asked about solutions. You know, how do you solve this? And her quote was, "I don't have all the answers. I think it's possible to educate young athletes, but you probably have to start before they even reach puberty. Maybe when they're 11, 12 or 13, by the time they graduate to the main tennis tour, many patterns have already been set." And then she goes on to talk about the coaches, but just dealing with the players, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it? That, as I said, at the age of 11, I probably didn't have a care in the world and was playing with my friends and having sleepovers or whatever. That the age, you would have to sit down with an 11-year-old and try and educate them on this type of thing is just, wow. That's quite hard to comprehend coming from completely outside of it.
Yeah, and it's difficult because all of this stuff does get set very early on. It's why we just don't see many female coaches, for example, on the tour, because it is just ingrained into young girls that they need a man to be leading things. I mean, think of all the phenomenal former female players there are. There are thousands, tens of thousands littered through the world. You can't tell me none of them want to coach. You know, and it's... It's just that's not what the players are looking for. And it's a silly thing. It doesn't mean anything. It's just that's what they were sort of trained to look for from being very, very young. So it's very hard to go against that. And yeah, that's what I think. But
is it also harder? And you might relate to this more now you've got baby Rog, that I know we've said it's possible, but is it also maybe, I don't know this, you may have spoken with former female players who have families, harder? Because if a player came up to you and said, "Naomi, I want you to travel with me 48 weeks of the year," I'm guessing you're going to say no, partly, largely, because you have a family and baby Rog. So is that part of the issue as well, that it is easier in many respects for a male coach to go away and be away for those big chunks on tour?
Sure, well, it can be, but I've never been asked. So, it might be that is the situation, but yeah. I've never been asked. I think, did Billie Jean King once say, like, a few years ago, she's like, "No one's ever asked me to coach them. I'm Billie Jean King. This is ridiculous." Like, you crazy. Know, because we were having the phases of the super coaches with Boris, and let's not talk about Boris for the moment. We could do that. Wow. Oh, no, we don't have time. I don't know where that came from. We had that. You've got Goran now, of course, with Djokovic, and it's just not the case for the women. And as I say, if it was the case that they'd all been asked and they'd all said, "No, you know, it's just not for me," then sure, I'd entertain the idea. But they haven't been asked. They're not sitting there going, you know, Steffi Graf isn't sitting there thinking, oh, I wish these players would stop hassling me to do some work. You know, like, it's...
So maybe the assumption is made that you wouldn't do it because of your situation.
I don't know, maybe. Or as I say, I personally think it's just that they don't... the players do not look for... It's not that they don't want, it's that they don't look for. They're not trained to look for that. So it does mean that, you know, we have an overwhelming coaching group of men on the tour, and it's shocking. It's shockingly bad that there aren't loads of female coaches. It just doesn't make any sense. So you know, that's part of it, but that is a big part of it. That's part of the jarring that is stopping it from happening. But I think it's also important with this discussion, and I think this is why I love Pam's piece so much, and this is a conversation I have a lot. If I'm talking about potentially a coach that's behaved inappropriately or unprofessionally, or somebody who has a track record of unprofessional behaviour, could be a safeguarding issue, might not be. You know, tennis, I can't speak for other countries, but tennis in this country, the LTA, the safeguarding stuff has really gone through the roof. It is such a big, big focus. They work very, very hard on it now, but they were playing catch up like all sports were on it. But there is a big difference, you know, that sometimes it could be appropriate that a coach is not allowed to coach anymore, but they haven't necessarily done anything that's illegal and is going to put them in prison. Like, there are different levels to things, right? Like, so obviously, and I find that I have that conversation a lot when I'm saying this coach should not be allowed to coach anymore, for example, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then people will respond and be like, yeah, but you know, they haven't done anything illegal. And I'm like, yeah, I know, but I'm not saying they should be in prison. You know, yeah, it's a totally different conversation. You know, there's one thing of like, should this person be allowed to operate in society at all? And I'm like, well, yeah, that's fine. But should they be allowed to travel the world with teenage girls? No. Right. And that's the difference. And I think, and I would love for us, and I think we will get there, but I would love for us to get closer, I think, particularly with the WTA, but the ATP too, to being able to ban coaches that they feel have been inappropriate and should not be on the tour. And as I say, it's difficult because that means you have to have your own set of rules, your own investigations. A lot goes into that. That is not an easy thing to do because you can't just do it willy-nilly, obviously. But as I say, there's a big difference between somebody who is breaking the law and should be arrested and somebody who should not be in charge of, it could be junior girls, it could be women in their 20s. It doesn't matter if somebody is unprofessional and is not sticking to the rules, then I think that should be looked at.
And do you think things will be put in motion that there will start to be changes, whether it be Pam Shriver speaking out now or the safeguarding you said that the LTA have put in place that's gone through the roof recently? Do you see there being a change in the future? Do you see there being anything done at the moment to change things?
I think there will be. I think, as I say, we've been playing catch up a lot. All the sports have. I think tennis has done the LTA have done a really good job in this country of catching up because everyone's had to do it. But now that they are catching up, I would love to see them drive forward with something like that. And I think WTA, ATP, just to put some procedures in place now for that sort of thing to happen.
I think it's an interesting discussion. I'm glad we chatted about it. As you mentioned, the Telegraph to read it, the Tennis Podcast to listen to Pam Shriver. It was so interesting, the interview she gave. But before your subconscious starts talking about Boris again, I'm going to go.
Yeah, okay. Let's not do Boris.
That's for another time. But enjoy the rest of Madrid. I think I did finally come down on the side of Nadal. So enjoy the rest of Madrid. And then next week, it's all about Rome.
It is indeed.
See you then. Bye.